It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rick will be back with me on Wednesday. The ongoing civil war in Syria began in March of 2011. But since then, refugees have exited the country in masses. The number of refugees now numbers over 2.3 million, making this one of the largest forced migrations of people since World War II. This kind of forced migration will have a lasting impact on lives as well as cultural identities, economies, and relationships across the Middle East. During the past 2.5 years, the global community has taken a smaller role in aiding those involved in this crisis than similar crises historically. Washington Post senior correspondent Kevin Sullivan recently traveled to Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan with photographer Linda Davidson to document this crisis. The result is a multimedia report on 18 lives changed by the war, which can be found at the Washington Post. Kevin Sullivan joins us now. Kevin, thanks for joining the show.
My pleasure.
So 2.3 million. Could you give us a sense of the scale of this crisis beyond just that number?
Well, you got to remember, Syria is a country of about 22 million people. So you have 2.3 million who have actually left the country. There are another 6.5 who have been internally displaced, so who have been forced out of their homes but are still inside Syria. And then 3 million more inside the country who are, you know, in desperate need of humanitarian aid. So it's huge. I mean, it's more people than Rwanda. I mean, I think only Afghanistan and maybe what we saw in South Asia after World War II are really bigger movements of people. It's immense.
If we were talking about these kind of numbers with a natural disaster, say, we would expect to see a really big public humanitarian response. Are we seeing anything along that scale in this crisis?
We're really not. It's, you know, the UN has asked, it's the largest ask in their history. They've asked for $5 billion to help the refugees and those displaced inside Syria. And they've gotten only 62% of that. I mean, that's a lot of money, but to give you some perspective on this, look at the experience of Save the Children. They've been raising money for the refugees for almost 3 years, and they've raised about $1.6 million. In the first 2 weeks after the typhoon in the Philippines recently, they raised $6 million. And after the Haiti earthquake in 2010, in the first 6 months, they raised $26 million. So this just isn't getting the same sort of attention. It's not capturing the world's hearts and imaginations the way that some of these other catastrophes have.
Let's look at the impact these people are having on the areas they're going to. You have stats like, I think it was a refugee camp is now the fourth largest city in Jordan, I think it was. And these are people who have suffered physical difficulties, war, been being forced to move. When this many people are migrating, what kind of effect is this having on things like cultural identity and the countries that they're moving into?
Well, it's very, very difficult on everyone. You know, as you say, the Satri camp in Jordan is the fourth largest city there now, and the people there they're really not from anywhere at the moment. I mean, we watched a baby being born there, and this child. And there are probably a dozen born in the camp every day. This child is born into a nation that's not its own and really has no – part of the point we're trying to make with this series is that this is not a very temporary change. This is something that's going to last for years, decades, maybe for the entire lives of a lot of these people. And this baby we saw born in Jordan will be there for, you know, for the foreseeable future. And what that does to that child's identity is really anyone's guess.
And you mentioned people in Lebanon. When the Palestinians came there decades ago, they thought, you know, the Lebanese thought these Palestinian refugees would be there maybe a couple weeks.
Yeah, that's right. The Lebanese ambassador said to me that you know, this scares us to death because, you know, exactly when the Palestinians came here in 1947, we thought they'd be here for 2 weeks, and they're still there. So the Lebanese, unlike the Jordanians and the Turks, have not established formal camps. They're terrified to do that because they're just afraid that once they do that, you know, tents become more permanent shelters, become apartment buildings, become towns. And the Lebanese have seen what happens when these camps become, you know, permanent part of the landscape. And the Turks are terrified about that. The Jordanians are living it as a reality already. Everyone is afraid of this becoming permanent, but everyone knows that it's going to become at least something that's semi-permanent, and that's the rub.
when we hear a phrase like refugee crisis, it sounds makes me feel like it's kind of distant. It's sort of diplomatic jargony. A lot of what you're trying to do in your feature here is put a human face on this. And I was hoping you could tell a couple of the stories, including that of a father and his 7-year-old daughter, I think it was, wounded in a bomb attack. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we're trying to do. I think people hear this and they think it's just sort of, it's those people over there, and I think that's part of why they don't donate. But yeah, we met all kinds of people. This little 7-year-old girl, 5 months, we were there in October, and 5 months earlier, her home had been blown up by a bomb, you know, by a bomb dropped by a plane from the Syrian military, and it killed most of her family. And her father went digging through the rubble and found her, brought her to the hospital, and they told him that they couldn't do anything for her there. So she's now in a hospital in Turkey. And, you know, 5 months later, this tiny little girl is just, her body is just shattered. She's, you know, it's unclear whether she's ever going to be able to walk again. You know, we saw this over and over and over again. We saw in Lebanon, we saw 50 people living in a junkyard. And, you know, they're all, and these kids are all walking around in sandals or bare feet, and the ground is all glass and metal and scars or open wounds on their hands and feet everywhere we went. We met a guy who's 105 years old. He was actually quite hysterical. But for 104 years, this man lived in the same village in Syria, and then the fighting came and forced him out. We met an 18-year-old girl with a big wound the size of a quarter in her back where she had been hit by a sniper. We met an 11-year-old boy working in a park selling tissues to try to raise a little money for his family. You know, over and over and over again, you see these people who, you know, were just like people that you and I know. I mean, we met a plastic surgeon in Lebanon who lived an incredibly elegant lifestyle back in Syria, and now it's just, you know, his money's about to run out, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. So it's really tragic stuff.
Well, and when you think of any one of these things happening to a person, being shot, losing their family, losing livelihood, losing their home, losing their country, and all of these things are happening to people at the same time, how do they talk about this? How are they bearing up under it?
Well, you know, imagine this happening to you. And or to you or to me, and that's how they're doing it. It isn't like these people are somehow have genetic predisposition to being good refugees. These are people who had real lives, and suddenly they're gone, and they all want to go home. I didn't meet one person who didn't want to go back to Syria, not under the current circumstances, but someday to return to their home. But they also understand that their lives there are gone. I mean, their homes have been bombed, their villages are gone, entire city blocks. I mean, we've all seen the pictures. There is no life for them to go back to. So now they're faced with trying to retune their minds to the idea that they're going to be living in a foreign country maybe for the rest of their lives. And, you know, some people, you know, I talked to one guy who's living in the back of a truck, and he said, and he laughed all the time. He made a lot of jokes, and I said, "Boy, you certainly seem to be taking this well." And he said, "Well, you know, we laugh because we have to. We laugh because we're desperate." And I think that's the truth here, is that this is happening to normal, everyday people from all walks of life who never ever imagined that they would be in this situation.
How do they talk about the politics of the war and the people who are leading the fight on both sides of it?
Well, you know, generally speaking, these are people who don't like the Syrian government and blame the government for what's happened to them. But you do find other people. I met, you know, a couple of people who said that they had been forced out of the country because of violence, you know, because terrible things that had happened to them from the rebels. So this is, you know, there's more than one side to this. I mean, people are being forced out for all kinds of reasons, and mostly I met people who were just heartbroken that it had happened. I mean, they're angry, but more than that, they just want to go home.
Are we being the world, I guess, anywhere close to meeting the immediate needs of people for food, sanitation, shelter, maybe education for the kids?
No, not even close. You know, Turkey has done a remarkable job. They've spent $2.5 billion on these camps, and they have 200,000 people in camps now. And the camps are, you know, it's not summer camp, but it's not. You know, the conditions are pretty reasonable. They're doing okay. But then, you know, they have 700,000 refugees in the country, so most of them are living outside of camps. And in just terrible conditions. And these people don't have, a few of, some of them go to school, some of them have clean water, some of them are doing okay or have health care, but I would say the vast majority don't. And, the worst snowstorm in years has hit the region in the past week or so. And these are people in plastic sandals, who are now dealing with snow on the ground. I just don't know how they do it.
All right. Kevin, thanks for joining us and thanks for your coverage of this story.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Kevin Sullivan with The Washington Post. We've been talking about his feature series on Syrian Civil War refugees. Coming up next, we'll take a look at answers to some of our everyday science questions with a Wisconsin science teacher who's become known as Mr. Science. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to our next guest, a basic understanding of the scientific world is a key to making informed decisions about everything from what to eat to which car we should buy, a lot of other stuff too. Larry Scheckel, a.k.a. Mr. Science, is a retired Toma High School physics teacher. He writes a weekly science column for the Toma Journal, and his new book is Ask a Science Teacher, 250 answers to questions you've always had about how everyday stuff really works. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So I touched on this just now, but even if we're not scientists, why is it important to think scientifically?
Well, I think science is a cultural pursuit as well as any other kind of pursuit. And to know more about science is to understand our world, not to get ripped off in some cases, to appreciate the beauty of God's creation. So I think there's a lot of other reasons to understand science. Good voting decisions, for example.
A lot of us might think back to being overwhelmed by a particular science class or finding a topic over our head, but is it fun?
Well, I think it is. I think it's what the teacher makes us a lot of times, and sometimes we've gotten away from that rote memory kind of work, and it's more collaborative and project-based science that we see in schools today.
Now, you taught high school science there in Toma for a good long time. What are some of the scientific questions that just keep coming up again and again for you over the years?
Well, it's the usual ones, Rob. It's the ones like, why is the sky blue and why is the grass green? If kids are asking questions, it's a lot to do with the human body, and they'll want to know why we burp or why we itch, or they want to know things about when they get a cold or a sickness or illness. If they're studying the stars, then there are questions about astronomy and things of that sort.
Well, I've got to say, I can't let it go. Our producer, Amanda Magnus, gave me one question that she was badgering me to ask you. Why is the sky blue? you just listed.
Sure. And see, those are the toughest questions, the ones that are really seem simple. But the reason the sky is blue has to do with the scattering of light, reflection of light, wavelength, frequency. And the reason the sky is blue basically is that light is made up of seven colors, the so-called Roy G. Biv colors, the Biv, the blue, indigo, violet being the shortest waves, and the Roy, red, orange, yellow, being the longest waves. And blue, those short wavelengths, are scattered so much easier than any other wave. So when those light rays hit the atmosphere, molecules of oxygen and a little bit of particles of dust and smog, then the shorter particles reflect off of those, the light reflects off those particles, and that's called scattering. So it's the scattering, it's called Rayleigh scattering, and it's wavelength dependent.
And it's different, or different things happen at sunset when you get those clouds in there and you get a little different scatter, I guess?
Yes, because when the sun is low on the horizon, either morning or evening, or if there's a lot of pollution in the atmosphere, the blue is all scattered out. So the only thing that's getting through then, through the atmosphere, is the Roy colors, the red colors. And that, therefore, we have the red sunsets and red sunrises.
Amanda is a grown-up of sorts, but that's a question that kids will often ask. They're really curious. Do kids ask better questions than grown-ups, do you think?
Well, I think they asked really simple questions, the kind of questions that, for example, that Einstein said that he always tried to answer. Kids will ask questions like, who made God and why? Why are people mean to each other? Why is there a chance that gravity may fall? What's the meaning of life? Why can't their dog talk? Why do pigs snort? Who's the shortest person on Earth? How long would it take me to get to Venus? They ask questions like that. And they're not afraid to ask those kind of questions that maybe grown-ups are a little reluctant to come up with.
Yeah, why don't grown-ups do that? Are we less curious, or do we just not want to look dumb and figure, oh, I should know this, everybody else does, so I'm not going to ask?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. People, you know, it's just a human reaction that we don't want to appear to be stupid or dumb, and therefore we don't ask those kind of questions that that probably a lot of other people are also asking.
And the worry that it might be over our heads, I think it was the physicist Richard Feynman who said, and I'm massively paraphrasing it wrongly here, but something like he told other scientists, if you can't explain it in a way your mom understands, you don't understand it well enough.
Well, that's right. And I remember Feynman saying that and reading about that. And it's true about in the very area of teaching. Now, my wife and I taught at Tolma High School here for a total of 70 years. And I taught physics for 38 and a half, and even after teaching that many years, I still had struggled with certain things that I taught, such as quantum mechanics or quantum physics or lasers and things like that. And it's the more a person teaches it, the better he himself understands it. So that's kind of a blessing to me, being able to try to explain it to others.
You've got 250 answers in your book. I want to get to some more of them during our conversation here. You mentioned kids asking about gravity. Let's tackle that one. Why does the Earth have gravity?
Well, the first one to really tackle that was Newton. And he basically said that any two objects that have mass have an attraction between them. And there's a formula, a well-known formula that he enunciated. But Einstein came along and said that gravity is the result of curved space, and that if an object is accelerating, then that acceleration engenders mass or gravity. And that's still not fully understood, you know, Rob, because you talk about the God particle or the Higgs particle that was recently talked about this last summer. They're trying to come up with a way to prove that mass or account for why objects have mass. So gravity is one of those great things that Einstein was told not to tackle after he had done relativity. But he says, I'm too stubborn, I'm going to do it anyway. And he did, and we're all the better for it.
That's one of the most mind-blowing things to me is that gravity, right? We deal with it all the time. We drop stuff, we fall down, we have to fight it to stand up or jump up. And it's we don't understand exactly completely how it works.
Yes, that's true. Matter of fact, one of the questions that a kid asked is, if the moon is so heavy, why doesn't it fall? And that's a very tough question and to deal with.
Okay, go for it. Why isn't the moon conking us on the head?
Well, the reason is that it's in orbit around the Earth. And if the moon stopped dead in its tracks, it would be attracted to the Earth and smash into it. Now, if there was no gravity, on the other hand, the moon would just keep going in a straight line and be lost forever, like a rock that you swing around on a rope and then cut the rope and the rock goes twirling out. But those two things are operating together. At the same time it wants to go forward, gravity is pulling it a little bit towards the Earth, making it go into a circular, fairly circular orbit.
Here's a related one that I don't think it's in your book, but one that always baffled me. So all the planets, right, orbit around the sun on a plane.
Yeah.
It's not like one plane is Jupiter, one plane is Earth. Why? Why aren't they all going in their own sort of circles?
Well, I think that has to do, my best understanding of that is in the formation of the solar system, is that all this debris started accumulating and it got going into a circle. And the idea of the conservation of angular momentum, a fancy term that means that when objects go around and round, they like to be drawn inward. So it kind of makes sense that it would be into a plane rather than random, just because of the accretion of more and more material.
We're talking to Mr. Science, Larry Shekel. His new book is Ask a Science Teacher, 250 Answers to Questions You've Always Had About How Everyday Stuff Really Works. I just asked one of mine. Now you can ask one of yours. And it doesn't have to be astronomy. We were on that for a little while there. Anything in the science world, maybe he can take a stab at it. You've always wondered why, but maybe been embarrassed to ask because you think it's obvious or somebody already knew it. Here's the number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you stump him, you know, you've got something for his sequel there that he can tackle in his next book. You can also email your question. It's talk@WPR.org. We'll take your questions, and I've got a whole bunch more for him, too, coming up after we take a look at the latest Wisconsin news. By the way, if you're into the science, after 5 today, the hunt for neutrinos and the important role Wisconsin plays in hunting for this bizarre, elusive subatomic particle. And it was written, this book, in a way that I understand, so you will, too. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on WPR. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Larry Scheckel, author of Ask a Science Teacher, 250 Answers to Questions You've Always Had About How Everyday Stuff Really Works. He is a retired physics teacher from high school in Toma. We're taking your questions about all things scientific, something you're curious about. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Speaking of email, Jeff in Rhinelander emails us. Larry, he writes, why do we only see part of the moon? If we see the sun and part of the moon, it can't be reflected off the sun, right?
Yeah, we see part of the moon, the phases of the moon, I take it, that the questioner is asking. The phases are caused because the moon goes between us and the sun as it goes around the Earth. And so if the moon is right in front of the sun, that's a new moon. And if it's on the other side of the Earth, that's a full moon. So in between, you have first quarter, and you have some other phases, crescent and gibbous phases, and last quarter. Any object that passes between us and the sun will go through phases, including Venus, by the way.
And we always see the same face of the moon is always getting the sunlight, right? Sometimes that face is away from us, sometimes it's toward us.
Yeah, the same side of the moon is towards the Earth all the time. So over a period of years, we see about 58-59% of the moon. And the reason for that is that the rotation rate of the moon is locked to its revolution rate around the Earth. So it rotates on its axis once a month, whereas the moon goes around the Earth once a month. And that's a locking system that is in place there.
All right, we have another astronomical question with David on the line in Osseo. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you got?
If the universe started with a Big Bang, infinitely small, or at least very, very small, and a huge amount of energy, and there was an explosion, then how is it that the universe is expanding and accelerating? My understanding is that all objects that have mass have gravity to some degree. How is it that the universe is expanding, but increasingly expanding? In other words, accelerating. It should be decelerating.
Well, Rob, you have some tough questions there. And that's a good one, but from my understanding is that when the Big Bang occurred, all objects that were created moved away. And so we, on Earth here, when we look out, we see things moving away from us in every direction. It's much like if you put a dot on a balloon and then a series of other dots. You took one big dot and you kept blowing that balloon up. If you were on that big dot, you would see all those other little dots moving away. And the amazing thing is the objects that are the furthest away are the ones that are moving the fastest, which is an additional proof of the Big Bang explosion roughly 14.3 billion years ago.
Interesting. And I know there's probably a lot of math and observation going into trying to figure out exactly how that's working.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, David. We go to Jeremy in Milwaukee now. Jeremy, hi.
Am I on?
You are on, Jeremy. What's your question?
Oh, sorry. My question is this. As a big science fiction fan, I've always wondered, as I've heard, that it's impossible to go faster than the speed of light. So I guess the two-parter, is that so why?
Well, that's an Einstein idea. There is that the speed limit of the universe is the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, roughly. And if you go faster than that, God will pull you over, if you will. But there's some speculation, something called worm tubes or wormholes, that things can go faster than the speed of light. It's very speculative, and there's not a lot of proof there. But I think it has to do a lot with the idea of relativity. I can't get any better answer than that.
And there was a brief glimmer of hope or thought that something had traveled faster than light, the CERN, C-E-R-N, I think it was, where it looked like a neutrino or something like that had gone faster than the speed of light, but looking back, they had other people check it out, and the measurements were just a bit off.
Yes, I remember reading about that. That's right, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's part of the fun part of science, isn't it? Or I don't know if it's fun for the people involved, but you find something, you put out your results, and then let everybody else try to pick holes in it.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And I get some feedback from the questions that I put in the newspaper every week, and they're good questions that people bring up. I was trained in the physical sciences, chemistry and physics, so in the life sciences, and there are quite a few questions about life sciences, geology, geography, and so forth, that I have to turn to people that know something about it. So I have a couple of doctors in Tolma that I talk to, and a dentist, an engineer, a couple of professors from the University of Milwaukee that are retired. So nobody has the answer to everything. So I tend to be very humble about that and say, well, I just don't know. The other day I was to a meeting, and somebody brought in some mushrooms and thought I should be able to identify those mushrooms. Well, I don't know much about mushrooms, you see. So the world is too big, and there's too much information out there to know everything.
You had here's one fun biology question you tackled in the book. Why do we get hiccups?
Oh, hiccups, now I have to take a look at that again, but I think it has a lot to do with the muscles that are in the diaphragm, and they get irritated. And so when those muscles get irritated, the muscles will stretch and cause the hiccup then.
And I'm worried that there will be some kind of psychosomatic impact of me even bringing it up, and I'll hiccup the rest of the show. Knock on wood, which isn't science, but we'll hope that doesn't happen. Julian in Milwaukee is with us now. Julian, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. My question, is time linear, and is time travel possible? Two questions, I guess.
very good question. Well, about time being linear, that I tend to believe is true. Time is one of those big mysteries. There was a Nobel Prize winning scientist that says time is a way of having everything not get in the way of each other. And another scientist said time is one damn thing after another. But time travel, I think, is way out there. I do not think, of course, the theory of relativity says that there's time dilation. So if you travel fast enough, then time will slow down for the person who is the traveler. However, we don't have near the energy to make things travel anywhere, any object of any consequence travel near the speed of sound. For example, the fastest man ever traveled was 5 miles a second coming back from the moon, and 7 miles a second. And light travels 186,000 miles a second. So we're not even close to that. We can make things in accelerators go close to the speed of light, but those are very tiny particles with very little mass.
Thanks for the call, Julian. And one more call. We've got Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hi there, Joe.
Hi. See, I've always wondered, when you roll up a garden hose, you lay it out flat in a linear effect, and you coil it up, you have to rotate it as you pull it in or twist. Is that something akin to Newton's bucket of water? Is that space acting on matter?
You mean when the water is going through, Joe, the water is going through the hose?
No. Well, no, not the hose. When Newton took a bucket and spun it, the water sits still for a moment and then picks up. And is that the effect, the drag, let's say, that space has on time? And is that something when you coil up a three-dimensional object? If the hose were just a pure line, would you have to coil it? Hmm. Would you have to let it rotate as you pull it into the coil?
Interesting.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think I really have a good answer for that one, Joel.
That's taking me back. It sounds like something they might have asked me on a physics exam back in high school or college and try to blow my mind.
Yes.
I've got to think that's just the 3D geometry, though. I don't know if it's good, if it's
right.
That funky.
Yeah.
I've already rolled up my hoses for the winter.
We're all done.
Well, before I let you go, Larry, when you get that question you can't answer, you don't know the answer to right off the bat, like what kind of mushroom is this? What's next? How do you pursue it beyond there?
Oh, I look up on the internet and then I ask people who know a lot. We have some good biology teachers here in Tolma, so I ask questions of them. And you know, if you ask around, there's somebody usually will have answers to questions. And. And that's why I'm very grateful for that.
And don't be afraid to ask the question.
That's right. Like. And at the end of each, most of the questions, I tend to put a little pun or a little joke about one out of every four if it pertains to something. And people kind of like that, so I enjoy doing that.
Larry?
They get their picture in the paper, and they get a coupon from McDonald's and from Pizza Hut, and so it's a...
Well,
it's a great adventure.
I need to start writing some questions up to Tolma there. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and everybody at WPR and also all your listeners.
To you as well. That was Mr. Science Larry Shekel, author of Ask a Science Teacher. Coming up next year on Central Time, we'll look at our love-hate relationship with winter in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. Do you live for these cold winter months, or do you dread the snow and the freezing weather? Let us know how you embrace or tolerate winter at 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We'll take your calls in a few minutes. How do you feel about winter? Do you love the snow and cold and get out every chance you can? Or do you hole up as much as you can all season waiting for spring? What do you do to get through the winter? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Winter officially starts this weekend. It's a season that invites strong feelings among us here in Wisconsin. In today's Wisconsin Life, writer Christy Clancy tells us about her own ambivalence to this time of year.
Like a dieter thinking about the new year, I think about the approaching winter and make plans for how I'll deal with it. I'll be honest. What I really want to do is curl up in my flannel sheets and come out of hibernation when the lilacs are in bloom. But since that's not an option, I tell myself this will be the winter that I'll get out there so much that my blood will get as thick as petroleum jelly. I'll go for brisk walks in my sleeping bag coat and suck up vitamin D through my face. I'll use the skis in my garage that are getting brittle from disuse. I'll try to be more like the crazy people I know and envy who don't mind and even relish the cold. My brother-in-law could spend all day in hockey skates clearing snow off a frozen lake with a broom to make a gigantic skating rink. I know cross-country skiers and snowshoers who can't wait to put on their ultralight down jackets and head outdoors as soon as the snow falls. I have cycling friends who stud their bike tires and clean road salt out of their derailleurs when they get home. For them, winter is the best season. They sleep with their window open a crack. They find beauty in the snow on the branches, the low, clear light, and the sight of their breath suspended in air in front of them. Don't these icicle huggers know that winter is supposed to be unlovable, punishing, dangerous? Jack Frost kills his victims by covering them with snow. Exposed to the elements for too long, Our digits can turn blue and fall off. Winter means a search for the missing glove, slipping on black ice, clearing crud off our windshields with the edge of a credit card, that gross dampness on your wool scarf after it's been on your mouth, the mushroomy smell of boots and wind like rocks in your face. Winter lovers will tell you that it's all about having the right gear. I wish it were that simple. I'm one of those people who think of cold as a form of pain. What I love about winter isn't the cold, but the way I protect myself from it. I like the contrast the bitterness creates between warmth, like sea salt on dark chocolate. When I try to think about what I love about winter, I think of soup on the stove, my favorite sweater, curling up on a couch with a down throw and a book. I think of hot chocolate and fires and steaming radiators. I think I could handle winter better if it didn't stick around so long. But I reach a point when the snow turns to dirty slush, my happy lamp stops working, and the heating bill could be mistaken for a college tuition invoice. Winter's okay until I hate it, and it gets ugly when I cross that line, something that could happen in a matter of months, weeks, or days. But for now, the season of fender benders and broken hips has just begun, and I'm cautiously optimistic.
Christy Clancy teaches English at Beloit College. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information on our website at wisconsinlife.org and find Wisconsin Life on Facebook. We'll continue our winter talk with Galen Druk, a Central Time producer, about his love for winter. And you can join in, too. Do you love winter, or are you more of a summer person and you maybe dread winter? What do you do to make it through the long, cold Wisconsin winter? Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Galen, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you moved here. Your last abode was in upstate New York. What was your impression of the Wisconsin winter so far? This is your first winter here. It seems like you've been here forever.
I know, right? So far, I like it. I've heard that it's been a little colder than it usually is, and also
True.
More snowy. So actually, I don't know. Maybe I like an upstate New York winter better because I love snow.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, so far, it's been going pretty well. But yeah, I'm a big winter aficionado, so hopefully Wisconsin will meet my standards.
Your high standards. What is it you love about winter?
I guess, I mean, there are a whole bunch of reasons, and it's not just a dislike of summer. Although I would say that definitely really cold is better than really hot. I think, first of all, winter can motivate you, right? Like, summer can't. Like, when it's really hot outside, you kind of just want to sit still and not really do anything. But when you go outside in the winter, you just want to move around, cross-country ski, downhill ski, snowshoe, run, have a snowball fight. And there's something about sort of being able to be active but not completely uncomfortable in the winter that I really like.
Okay, now what about staying inside? Does winter make us appreciate the inside more?
Yes, guilt-free.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the summer when it's really nice outside and you just want to spend the whole day in bed binge-watching TV, you feel guilty, right? You know, it's like 5 o'clock and you haven't been outside yet.
You're missing this great weather.
Exactly, what am I doing with my life? I've been in bed all day. But in the winter, you say, wow, I know what I'm doing in bed all day. It's -5 degrees outside.
We'll go to our callers. We've got, that's at 800-642-1234, by the way. You can join in with why you love or hate winter, how you enjoy it or tolerate it. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We have Ian on the phone in Green Bay. Hi, Ian.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to comment that I don't think Christmas would be anything without, you know, the snow and the cold. I think it, like, brings a cheer into the air. And we have people coming from Tasmania, Australia, actually, in a couple days. And this is going to be their second time seeing snow, and they love it. They say it's the fluffy white stuff, and they can't get enough of it. And they always come every 3 years. So, I don't know. It's like a winter wonderland in Green Bay right now.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Ian, and thanks for being the ambassador of snow to the people in Australia.
You know, I completely agree. So snow is almost magical for me. I mean, there's nothing else. Like, it does, when it rains or when, you know, there's a tornado, it doesn't sort of other kinds of storms don't really create some sort of like magical scenery. Whereas snow, I mean, it makes everything white. Isn't that amazing? I mean, what do you think about it? You go outside, it's snowing here right now. We're in Madison. It's snowing a lot, actually. We're going to go outside and everything is going to be white. How awesome is that?
And snow on the trees, the bare trees covered in snow. I mean, that's no artist could come up with something that awesome.
I'll agree with you.
By the way, I'll out myself. I'm on the fence. I kind of like winter. It kind of overwhelms me. I'll say a thing that I like the most about it is the camaraderie when you're walking and you see somebody stuck in the snow. Maybe this is just Wisconsin. You are obliged to go out and help push them out. I've been on both sides of that transaction many times, and it gives you a little faith in human nature. You don't know the person, you know anything about them. You help them push their car out.
I hear that, absolutely.
Back to the phones now. We have Matthew in Muskego. Matthew, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What are your thoughts on winter?
So every year, my family, since ever can I remember, I play guitar and we all sing outside on the streets for money for the Salvation Army. And there's just something about surviving. People contribute more and they feel bad for you, you know, putting up with the cold. And there have been a couple of times where I play a song and I can't feel my fingers halfway through, but it's a good time. So.
And the guitar is going flat in the cold, probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're there, that's a great play for sympathy. If you're there suffering in the winter, people are going to give you more money. Thanks for the story, Matthew. Galen, one thing before we go back to callers, we were talking about just before we started here is you love layers. You love wearing the layers in the winter.
Yeah, I mean, there's something almost, it takes you back to the womb, you mm-hmm. know? You get to bundle up with scarves and mittens and, you know, boots and everything. And then when you go outside, you almost feel protected and it's nice. I mean, there's no feeling like that in the summer, except for maybe being in a pool or something like that. But yeah, and then when you go inside after being outside, freezing cold, you go inside and it's immediately warm. There's something so instantly gratifying about that. Where I mean, I don't think air condition has the same feeling.
Not at all. And my thing that's similar to that is the covers in bed. I think it's easier to sleep way better when you've got a couple few pounds of quilts on you than in the summer when you've just got a sheet and a cat attacking your toes through it.
Also easier to sleep way later.
True, because the sun comes up so much later. Christian in Black River Falls is with us now. Christian, hi.
Hello?
Hi, Christian. Yeah, you're on the air.
Yep. Hey, I was just saying that because I came from a warm place, from Las Vegas, and I was born in Los Angeles, California. And for me, when we first moved out here, because my mom got a job down here, and I was in sixth grade, and it was just like the first time I seen snow, so everybody outside was laughing at me, and it was just amazing. But for other people are different, so some people will say they're like a warm place, and for me, I like a warm place, but winter and Christmas, it's amazing. So,
thanks, Christian. And Sam in Milwaukee is on the line too. Sam, hi. I want to hear your thoughts too.
I like the winter for the snow. I'm a snowboarder and a snow kiter, and when the lakes freeze over and powder gets on the lake, you can go out with a kite and a board and just really cruise. It's a little different than riding the waves in the summer, but it's really nice to be able to cross the whole lake on solid ice.
Sam, thanks to you and thanks to everyone else for their calls. Galen, a winter activity, a snow activity that you want to try that you haven't done yet? Maybe you want to get it in this winter.
Yeah, well, I have never cross-country skied before. I am a downhill skier, but when I moved out here, my friends recommended I try cross-country skiing, and I hear that you can do it in town when it snows a lot, so I'm excited to do that.
All right, good luck with that. Galen, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now back to work. You can keep the conversation about winter going on our Facebook page. We are Central Time on WPR. Coming up, an astrophysicist and the hunt for neutrinos in Wisconsin and Antarctica. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.